everybody. Thanks again for joining us here on Expanded Perspectives with me, Cam Hale. And as always, I can't get rid of him, the man of the hour, Mr. Filio, big Philly, big freedom, Fizzy Filson. Kyle Filson.
How's it going, everybody? Yes, I'm here in Skeleton Studios on a cool Texas day. Getting ready for spring, getting ready for a lot of things to happen, like continuing education courses and stuff, boring things like that, getting your taxes done. Yeah, no, I'm here, man. I'm very excited. We're going to be speaking with a pretty interesting guest. It's been a long time since we've done an interview, and I think we're going to start doing some more of that because
I think so.
So many of these guys and gals, they send us books and things like that, and we kind of look through them and then put them like, yeah, we need to have them on. And then the next thing you know, it's 2 months later, then 6 months later, and like the case with our guest today, it's like almost a year later. Like, man, time goes by.
Yep.
Because you're constantly, you'll have an article or you'll see something and be like, oh, I know what I'm doing next week's show over. I'm going to be talking about some gnomes. And then the next week, Cam's like, oh, I got some, you know, crazy black dog sighting. Oh, okay, Leah, let's do that. And you just, time goes by. Yep. But Vera, what have you been up to, Brad?
Man, oh, man, I have been busy. I sold one of my trucks.
That's right. Yeah.
I sold my little Toyota pickup, got rid of it. And then I had to go. I'm like, well, dang, now I need a trailer because I got rid of the little truck, you know. So I'm like, now I need a trailer. So I had to go get a trailer. So I had to turn around and go buy me a flatbed trailer so I could haul some stuff around. Then I've got some projects in the works. I have to build a changing table for
a baby.
For a baby, yeah. I'm going to build a changing table I'm building an adult-sized changing table. I don't know what's going on, but my brother-in-law requested it. Said he likes it for something or other whenever his wife, my sister-in-law, changes him. I don't really know what's happening, but I want to build, you know, it's for a baby. But I have several projects on the list. I'm fixing to start remodeling my bathroom at home. So I have my daughter's bathroom, not ours, but my daughter's bathroom. So I got to start a remodel on it. I have a lot of construction stuff coming up in here too. But the weather's getting good, you know, springtime flowing, and I enjoy it. You know what I mean? Like, I enjoy messing around with stuff like that. So those are some things that I've got going on. And speaking of got going on, as Kyle alluded to, we're going to get to talk to a fellow named Pat Aiken about his Elkins Creek book. But before we get into that, Kyle, I got you something.
All right. Yeah, please.
A caped, not just winged, but a caped winged humanoid.
It has wings and it's wearing a cape.
I'm assuming.
Now, I'm a big fan of the cape. People don't really wear capes anymore.
No,
like,
they
it used
don't.
To be fashionable. What's the difference between a cape and a cloak? Does a cloak have like a collar or a hood on it? And then a cape is just,
I think the cape
hoodless?
Just covers just the back also. Like, it doesn't come all the way around. Where it looks like a cloak is like over the, maybe the cloak is over the shoulder, whereas the cape.
I got you.
Over the shoulder with a hood, as you point out, whereas the cape, but like Little Red Riding Hood, she just had like a cape and a hood.
I dig the cape.
So maybe the cloak. You don't like the I don't know.
Well, it depends on if it's cold out or not. When it's warm out, you wear your cape. When it's cold, you wear your cloak.
Your cloak. Good call. Good
I mean,
call.
Other than like vampires and pimps, I don't know anybody else that can just like walk around freely with a cape.
Gentlemen in like movies and British, old British movies and television shows, some of those have capes.
Yeah, but that's what I'm saying. It was fashionable back in the day, like in London, back in like Jack the Ripper days.
1850s?
I don't know.
Yeah, 1880s.
I don't know the
1850s
exact
right around
time zone that the cape was fashionable, but it would be pretty
I'm
cool
gonna
to
search
wear
that up.
Have you ever seen the guys that like they create themselves as a superhero and they go around like kind of like a vigilante?
I watched that video or that movie.
Fighting crime. No, this isn't a movie. Like, these are real people, like in New York.
I watched a documentary.
Oh, about, you said
about
movie.
Those
I thought you meant like a movie. I got
no,
you.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah, my bad. No, I watched a documentary on those dudes.
Well, they found one dead a couple days ago. Like, I guess he was trying to fight crime.
Oh,
and,
no.
Doesn't really work when the person you're trying to stop has a 40 caliber or 45 or whatever the guy had. Yeah, so, I mean.
I wonder if he had a cape.
I think so. I don't remember his superhero name. It's sad because the person's trying to fight crime, but, you know, you got to be careful. Some criminals, they ain't having that.
You want to do it professionally. You don't want to dabble in the amateur division of fighting crime. That's not a really good thing to do.
Some people, when they're looking at hard time, they're like, no, you can take your mask and your cape.
Yeah, and your little nunchuck or whatever you got over there, and you can take the business into my pistol.
I think of the old Indiana Jones movie when the guy's got the sword, he's whipping it around, he's just kind of watching, and then he just pulls out his gun and shoots it.
Yeah. I'm thinking of I believe you, but my Tommy gun don't.
Yeah. Anyways.
Oh, my bad. Anyhow, so they encounter this caped winged humanoid.
Yeah, please tell me more.
Near Chicago. So we're here we go again.
Here we go.
O'Hare International Airport. So this came from an eyewitness who stated that he and his son observed a caped winged humanoid in Bensonville, Illinois. So, like I said, yet again, Lon helps us out, says, hey, check this. The eyewitness's name's Brian.
Mm-hmm.
So Brian said that one evening in August of 2006 that he and his adult son were sitting on the back porch of his home in Bensonville, Illinois. Now, this location is a village that borders the southwest edge of O'Hare International Airport. The eyewitness's neighbor has a large pine tree in the adjacent yard. Now, both Brian and his son were looking in that direction when a large being, dark being, quickly dropped to the ground from the tree and grabbed a squirrel with its talons. The squirrel was literally screaming during the attack. The dark being then quickly jettisoned up into the tree. Now, both witnesses could hear the being moving up the tree, but neither caught sight of it again. Brian describes the humanoid as having strong, long, grasshopper-like legs with muscular thighs. It seemed to have cape-like wings that were wrapped around its body. Now, these wings were never unfurled. He estimates the height of the humanoid at 6 foot or so. There was no distinct head or eyes, but the overall size and form was too large to be any bird that the longtime resident had ever seen or heard described. Now, both witnesses were shocked at what they had seen, and like anybody else would be like, holy crap. And I asked about not getting a photo, which I was told that it happened so quickly that they didn't even have a chance to.
So this creature, it didn't actually, it wasn't wearing a cape. It had cape-like wings.
Yeah, it wasn't a cape.
I got you. Because like if it's a creature, like Jeepers Creepers or something like that, and it's wearing a cape, I mean, it would have to have one sewn for it.
Yeah.
Made. It would have to go to a department store. Yeah. Like, I don't even know where you would get, I mean.
A monster acquires a cape.
Like, you know, how would that happen? But it, I got you. It's cape-like wings. Still, I mean, regardless if it's wearing a cape or not, terrifying, right?
And,
I mean,
yet again, what could it be? What could you misidentify that for?
I don't know.
I understand it being a bird, like if a bird had dropped down. But they're saying they didn't see the wings. It just like jumped out of a tree limb, grabbed a squirrel, and then jumped back up into the tree.
Wow.
Like a bird's going to use its wings. It's not just going to just stiff arm it and just fall down out of the tree and then be able to hop back into the tree without flapping its wings.
Wow.
And I've never heard of this thing, of the any of these humanoids attacking any animal. We've never had a report of an animal attack like it ever feeds. We never see it feeding.
Yeah.
And now this thing that he says is about a 6 footer is eating a squirrel.
Wow. Well, not every encounter with the paranormal is terrifying. Some people actually have a good experience.
Nice.
Check this out. This comes from Trudy. She says, when I was about 10 years old, I went on a drive with my parents into the English countryside to a place called Camberley in Surrey. We were going to lunch with my mom's longtime friend Jill and her husband Harry. We met them on the way at a country pub for pre-lunch drinks. As children, my brother and I were allowed to go around to the back garden, and we sipped lemonade and ate crisps. Then the adults brought their drinks outside. The garden of this pub had a row of handmade miniature houses at the bottom of the garden. Each one had its own pathway, gate, and door. Well, I wandered over to take a closer look, and to my utmost surprise, the doors of these tiny homes opened, and a small gnome exited from each one and came to talk to me. One was wearing a red hat. He was leaning on his garden rake, chattering away. I remember what they spoke to me about, but the vision of them has never left me. Oh, I don't remember what they spoke to me about, but the vision of them has never left me. Of course, when I walked back to tell my parents, I just received a pat on the head, and my mom said, "That's nice, dear." I had another experience when I came to Australia in the early 1980s. My partner and I visited a tea room during winter up in the mountains. They had a lovely garden, but no flowers. Anyways, the wind was blowing and it was quite cold. All of a sudden, I saw a small gnome with my inner vision, and he started talking to me. Let me show you my flowers I look after. That's what he told me. Again, looking around, I could see only the stalks and bare rose bushes. Anyways, I followed him along a pathway, and then he turned a corner. There, just around the bed, was a small bush with a beautiful white perfumed flower. There was no other flowers in sight. He was very proud of this flower and the bushes, and he thanked me for allowing him to show me. We also had a gnome called Tom that lived in our backyard in Sydney. He used to pop up now and again giving suggestions to help us with different plants. So that's my experiences with gnomes. They are gorgeous. Thanks, Trudy.
Hey, Trudy, thanks for the horticulturist gnome update.
Right? So not only is she seeing and talking to gnomes, he's helping them with their plants. How handy would that be?
If anybody knows, they should know. Right.
Yeah, that's the impression I get. Like, my grandfather had a really cool garden when I was a kid, and he had bees and everything, mm-hmm. you know, that would help pollinate the vegetables, and they were doing very good. Well, maybe he did, because, I mean, he was had a really green thumb. And I remember always like, man, his garden's better than any garden I've ever seen. But I never saw a gnome when I was out there. I wished I would have.
I still think. I
love the stories.
I love gnomes. I love the
But well, you resemble a gnome.
I know, this is very true.
I mean, if I put a red hat on you and some lederhosen and gave you a small rake.
That's what I'm going.
You would.
That's what I'm going for Halloween. I'm going to go as a gnome.
Yeah.
I need to find the picture that I had from the Halloween party where I'm dressed up as Grumpy.
Well, we bought you a gnome for Christmas.
It's on the front porch of my house.
Or is that your birthday? That was your birthday, I think.
It's on the front porch of my house. Yeah, so
it's giving everybody the bird.
It's just a gnome, little tiny, one about 9 inches tall. Giving everybody the finger, and it's just says, like, keep out is what it says, like, on the sign he's leaned up against.
Oh, man. Well, let's get into our interview, man. We had a guy on that's really interesting, James Pat Akins, and he wrote a book called Elkins Creek. And Pat is he was a former deputy sheriff who had a run-in with the paranormal unexpectedly, and it changed his view on everything. I mean, back then when this event occurred, he wasn't a squatcher. He wasn't into Bigfoot or anything, but he started getting these reports, you know, from an elderly couple, and they would call in to the sheriff's department and say that there was somebody lurking around their house. Someone was tapping on the walls of their house, causing problems. And he, you know, Pat made repeated visits to this elderly couple. And over time, he began to realize that this was not a human being, but something far, far scarier. The book is amazing. It's called Elkins Creek. And let's get into that interview. All right, y'all. We got a very special treat for y'all today. We haven't done an interview in quite some time, and we apologize for that. But we have someone on the line with us today that I think you're going to find very interesting. He had an interesting encounter of his own. He's also written a book. We're going to talk all about it. You know, on this show, me and Cam are constantly reading eyewitness accounts, sightings that people have had. And we've also mentioned numerous times how it's not just the sighting that we're interested in, but who's had the sighting. And if it's John or Jane Doe coming home late from a Christmas party and they see something strange cross the road, that's one thing. But when it's a sighting by a trained observer, like a fighter pilot, a biologist, and especially like those in law enforcement, their stories are more credible because these are trained observers. And the person we have on the phone today was in law enforcement at the time of this encounter. And we're happy to welcome to the show, Pat Akin. How are you doing?
Fine. How are you today?
We are doing good. I'm feeling a little better every day. I know people have been constantly sending me emails, checking up on me. But yeah, me and Cameron in studio, we're excited to have you on. I apologize. You sent us this book almost a year ago, and it's been
awful at checking the P.O. box.
Sitting on the shelf here at Skeleton Studios for almost 8 months or so, and it was a really interesting read.
Mm-hmm.
We get lots of books sent to us, and we do a lot of reading. We're not always lucky enough to have the people on that have written the book, but you reached out to us, and I apologize for taking so long to reach back out to you. And first, before we start, I would like to first thank you for your service, and then thank you for writing this book.
Yes.
And third, sending it to us.
Well, you know what? Thank you guys for the service you provide. by being an open platform and allowing diverse opinions and ideas in this community and in the broad spectrum of the paranormal community. I mean, I think that Expanded Perspectives is probably, if not the premier open source podcast for other people's opinions so that you can examine the broad spectrum of things. So for my part, I want to thank you guys for what you do.
Well, we appreciate it. We've been doing it almost 7 years. And me and Cam had a love for the paranormal. There's no judgment on this show. We like to hear sightings or experiences by all types of people and to keep an open mind. And I really enjoyed that. I even spoke to you before this interview. How in the very beginning of your book, you're talking about how you're not an expert. And don't listen to anybody out there who also claims to be an expert, because there's not really an expert when it comes to the field of cryptozoology. Now, there are people that are trained in certain aspects of things that, like, we'll look at casts, like Dr. Meldrum. You speak about him. We've spoken about him numerous times on the show. And so those things, those experts can leave more credence to a sighting or a footprint or something. But there's nowhere where anybody goes to become a cryptozoologist. So don't be fooled.
That's right.
If you're interested in this subject, like I'm sure we all are, everyone listening to this, it's, we like to hear the encounters. And just like you point out in the book, you should form your own opinion.
That's right.
But getting to the book, you are located in Georgia currently, right, and back when this event happened. Can you tell our listeners where this happened, back when it happened, what you were doing? I know I mentioned that you were in law enforcement. You were a deputy sheriff at the time.
That's right.
Yeah. If you could lay out the whole story, I think they're going to enjoy it.
Set the scene. Yeah, set the stage.
Okay.
Go for
it. Well, you have to understand that we're going to go back many years now, over 20. And it's rapidly, time's flying. So it's another year, I think maybe 24 or 25 now. But in 1993, I was the deputy sheriff working out of the Pike County Sheriff's Office in Pike County, Georgia. But the county seat is Zebulon. I don't know, people have called it Elkins Creek, Georgia, but Elkins Creek runs through the county. It meanders some 22 miles and empties down through Upson County into the Flint River. Okay, now that being said, understand that as in those days, my starting salary was $11,500. Okay, to give you an idea of what, eventually we got it up to 13 or so. it was very poor.
Right.
In those days, we did have a radio system, which was line of sight, which meant we didn't have a repeater like it's just the norm everywhere today. And a lot of times on calls, it was just me.
Right.
Because I was, in effect, the night sheriff. See, there was one deputy on duty, and I had people at the sheriff's office, the jailer, the dispatcher. But we were the emergency service. In fact, we had to call ambulances a lot of times from an adjacent county. You have to understand, at nighttime, we were pretty isolated. People went to bed. We might, on a Friday or Saturday night, have other sorts of activities, but it was very rural, and I was out there by myself. Now, I'm not telling you this to try to appear to be tough or whatever, but what it does do is it gave me a great respect very quickly in my law enforcement career for people like Texas Rangers back in the 1870s who were out there by themselves on horseback.
Yes, sir.
Because you have to rely on yourself.
Yeah, now, you had a very large county to patrol by yourself.
Right. By yourself. And you're out there and you hit in the topography, if you hit a low spot, you might not be able to call back for assistance. And the assistance most of the time was 30 or 45 minutes away. So, you went out there prepared. You jingled when you walked because you knew you were going to have to fight. You got out on the call, you put the radio mic out the window, left the car running so you have a chance to get back to call for help if you got into another.
Yes,
so it's kind of wild and woolly, even though it's 1990s. And people, rural places, they don't have all the technology. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. Let me go ahead and talk about this man. We would get these calls, and it started during that summer when it was turning from 1993 to 1994. This happened probably over a span 8 or 9 months. And he would call in and say, you know, somebody's tapping on the outside of my house. Now, the house itself, you ever seen somebody take a trailer and they build onto it and convert it into like a bigger house?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
yes,
that's the kind of house. And it was sat high up on the ground, from the ground. And in places, I mean, on the backside, because of the lay of the land, it was probably 8-10 feet tall from the ground itself. Well, he would call, he'd say, you know, we're getting these taps on the outside of the house and somebody's messing with us. Although he was more profane, and I'm not going to try to emulate that. I'm just saying he was upset. So, you know, he's way out there.
So he would make his call, and it would take you a while to get there.
That's right.
And by that time, whoever was tapping or whatever on the house, he was frustrated that it took you a while to get out there.
That's right.
I could imagine. Yeah.
Well, grumpy old men wanting you there right then. Yeah, that's the way it always works.
So, you know, I would respond, and I didn't take my job lightly. You know, I went out there. I'd get there, and, you know, I'd haul it. And we had those big V8 interceptors, Ford Crown Vics at that time, and it very easily could go over 100 miles an hour. So I'd go out there. I'd get there pretty quickly, probably 10, 15 minutes sometimes. Pull in. I'd go up to the door. But first, before I went in, we learned this in the academy, you know, I would always scan the area with my headlights as I turned in, watching, looking for people. Never saw anything. I'd get there, I'd get out, I'd go up and talk to him. And, you know, he'd say, somebody's tapping on the window. Somebody is beating on the house. Somebody's doing this. I'd say, okay, well, wait a minute. Let me go walk your yard. Let me look around and see, you know, do a prowler clearance is what we call it. You know, you go out. So I'd take my flashlight and I'd go and I'd look. And I have to admit, probably the very first weird thing that struck me was the smell. And I'd get out there, and it would be just god awful. And I did the best I could in the book to try and describe the smell, because it wasn't just something that was straight out like a rotten carcass or a sulfur smell. It was like an intermingled sort of smell.
I loved your description of it in the book.
I mean, you know, it's I don't ever want to smell it again, frankly. I mean, it was just awful. And I have a weak stomach anyway. So, you know, I go out there, I'd smell this, I'd look. I'd even, you know, get down, shine up under the house, look on the backside, go walk down to the tree line. But I had to be efficient about it, because while I'm sitting there, I hear the radio popping. They're calling me. And calls would pile up. You know, you can't spend forever. You got to clear it and go back into service, because somebody might be getting killed across the county. So I'd go check. And a lot of times I would have this eerie feeling. And, you know, I don't know how to describe it. It's like an electric shock. It's like all the hair along your neck and your back and your arms stand up. And it's just like almost something. The only way I can liken it to is, you know, like something on the African plains where you have right. encountered a lion or a cheetah or something. You're prey.
Right.
You know, that feeling. So
now, Pat, to back it up just a second, this couple, this elderly couple, they had been calling numerous times, right?
Right.
So you were pretty familiar after, like, say, the third or fourth time. All right. I know so-and-so. Did you notice that smell on your first call out there, or was it over time?
Over time.
Okay. And I remember specifically in the book, you talked about how the old man told you that he could smell it from inside of his house. Like, he would That's smell right. it, and then he knew that something was going to happen, that the creature or whatever was coming.
Right. Well, it's like I said, it was a slow escalation. By the time, I think if I recall, it was back in when August is turning to September-ish. But by the time we got into the fall pretty well, say October, those range, I understood what the guy was talking about because things would escalate. And he told me, I mean, on one occasion I'm talking to him, he said, you know, I know it's coming because I smell it. And I was like really skeptical. The truth is, you know, at this point, I never believed. I really, even up to the time I took the cast, I never believed that this was anything but somebody harassing the old man and his wife. And, you know, I just figured we have somebody in the neighborhood. This guy, either he's made them mad because he's kind of curmudgeonly, or somebody wants access back there to this creek and he wants him out of this house. You know, it was criminal to me in my mind. But we couldn't explain the smell. And it would. It just got worse and worse as it went. And the encounters started getting worse. I mean, he finally one day confessed to me on one call. He said, you know, he described, he saw it. And I said, okay, well, what did you see? He said, well, he said, you're going to think I'm crazy. And I said, no. I said, tell me because, you know. He said, it's an ape man. And I said, an ape man? I said, we're in Pikeham, Georgia. And he said, look, I saw it in profile. It was trying to see in the bathroom window, wherever. And I swear to you, it was an ape. He said, it looked like a caveman with an ape. And I said, I went around where he's talking about, looked at the window. That window was, 8 feet or something up off of the ground. For it to stand there and look in or him to see a profile, it was, to me at the time, it was an impossibility. And I said, well, perhaps what you saw was someone with an ape mask on. Because it's dark and you might make a mistake.
Yeah.
You know, you're upset and you see this thing and somebody's just trying to scare you. And, you know, we over time, he kind of softened towards me because I would listen to him. And I told him, said, you know, I'm trying to help you, but I'm just running into stuff out here that leaves no evidence. You know, not really. There's not much for me on this kind of call.
And I'm sure, not to cut you off, Pat, but I'm sure that's frustrating for you going out there over and over again. And he seems genuine and 100% honest and concerned for not just his safety, but his wife's and all that.
That's right. That's right.
And there's no evidence. Like, you're not seeing anything. Like, you've not found anything. There's just nothing there but his. And of course, you know, you start questioning, you know, is he losing it?
Right.
Is dementia setting in? Is something going on? And this is, we're going to go through this for the next 2 years until finally somebody has to step in.
That's right. Well, you know, I said that in the manuscript, in the book, I reached a place where I said, okay, he's on some kind of psychotropic drug. He's been prescribed something.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, people today, he might just be, you know, growing or making him something, you know, I don't know, but my opinion was he's under the influence of something. But you know what? The thing is, on the heels of that, on a subsequent call, he said the thing really popped his house. Now, this is around the time he said it started whispering to him. And on that day, on that call, I went back, and sure enough, there was a big dent in the back of the house in that vinyl siding. Now, I don't know how the listener or anybody knows about vinyl siding, but that's pretty tough stuff to hit it and leave a dent. Okay. You might bow it out of shape, but it's going to pop back because they design it that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked at this thing and it looked like somebody took, probably 13, 14 inches circular sort of depression in the back of the house. And I looked at it, but there wasn't any like knuckle prints or anything. It was just a big depression. And I told him, you know, I said, look, somebody had to have a lot of strength if they did this with their bare hands. I said, and it's a huge impression.
Mm-hmm.
The impact impression is just too much. And he's like, well, I told you. And he said, look, this thing is whispering, you know, talking to me. I said, what do you mean it's talking to you? And he said, well, it's real low, and he makes fun of me. I said, what do you mean? He said, he said, Peanut. He would call Peanut real low. And I don't know if I can do it today, but it was like, it's kind of what he what he said to me.
And Peanut was the old couple's pet dog.
That's right. And the thing is the inflection of what he said. This is when I started opening my mind about this. Because he said he makes fun of me. And I said, well, explain to him how he makes fun of you or whatever. And he said, in the daytime, Peanut doesn't go out at night. Peanut's a little chihuahua. Peanut, probably 9 pounds, you know, little. Look a lot like Peanut was mixed up with a Dachshund. They had something going on. But Peanut was not a sizable dog, but he is ferocious, like all chihuahuas are.
Mm-hmm.
But he only got to go outside. Mama only let him out, the old lady, in the daytime. And he would go out and do his business. Then one or the other would stand at the door and go, Peanut, you know, and call him back. Well, that meant to me, okay, if somebody's doing this, then somebody's watching the house in the daytime.
Mm-hmm.
They have to. They're watching the behavior of the old couple. And when that struck me, I felt like, okay, this is a different level or escalation of threat to these people. Because if they're taking the time to harass them at night and then they're sitting somewhere and they're watching their behavior pattern, you know, what are they planning? What's the end game for whoever this unknown person or persons is?
So still at this point, anything paranormal or cryptozoological had never crossed your mind?
No.
You're still, now you're beginning to think it real, like there's a real threat. I'm worried for these people now. Like something's going on. If he heard it whisper the dog's name, there's only one way to know it. And I'm assuming from the description in the book and then what you've told me is it's also a pretty good ways from the road. It's not like somebody'd pull over and jog across the front yard and whisper in the window and jump my car and leave. It's not like that. It's a long driveway to get back down in there.
That's right. And you know, it butted up against the creek in the back area. You know, they had some underbrush. And they were just high enough, and we do flood here some because we got a lot of creeks and rivers in Georgia, but they were just high enough out of the bottoms that if the creek flooded, that it wouldn't affect them unless it was just, you know, a tumultuous sort of thing. But if you went from the back of the house towards the creek, they had underbrush there. But once you broke through the underbrush and you got back on the creek a little bit, it was bottoms. And all the underbrush, because of the tree cover, just went away. It cleared out. So it was an easy walk back there. And I said, you know, my thought had been on several different things. The smell, well, maybe somebody has a hog pen over on the backside at nighttime. The smell's drifting in from there. Mm-hmm. Or my whole thought had been, we've got somebody back there behind in the creek. And this person is working their way up along the creek, and they're harassing them and using all this as cover.
Trying to rationalize it any way you can.
That's right. I'm trying to be a law enforcement officer. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to, you know, I can't, you know, people don't understand that. You can't go into your sheriff or whatever and say, hey, you know, there's a Bigfoot creature out. Well, you know, that's it, pal. You
can do it once.
That's right. You can. You can do it one time. And then, you know, next thing you know, in our case, you'll be over at West Central Georgia, you know, at the hospital.
Yeah.
But so I'm looking for, you know, people. After that incident, that's when the dog food in the corn. He had a little old shed down there, a little barn. Probably, I don't know, 20 square feet or something. It is big enough to house like lawnmower, that sort of thing. And he had kept corn and dog food in there in big sacks. Well, he had initially told me that he had big dogs and there was a pen, but all the dogs outside had disappeared. But this happened before I was really involved in this. So all I can do is, and I say that in the book, is relate that he said he had big dogs, and over time, they just were disappearing.
Mm-hmm.
Something come in, and broke, I mean, the hasp. I mean, it's just like a, you know, like a press, man. They just twisted this thing off, opened the door, and corn, dog food, all that was going, you know, 50-pound sacks, 40-pound. And he showed me that, and that really puzzled me. I was like, well, wait, you know, I can understand somebody going out stealing your lawnmower, but who wants, mm-hmm. you know, who wants a 50-pound sack of polished corn, you know, that's generally not criminals, you know, a farmer might want it or somebody raising something. But
well, even kids messing around would just tear stuff up and end up leaving, and right. then that's it. They're not going to be stealing dog food and corn and leaving the bags. What are they bringing, their own bags?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's, you know, so it didn't make sense. But I said, you know, people crazy. So maybe, you know, this is, you know, they got something going on back there. And then a few weeks went by and the tractor tire was up in the tree. Well, at this point, this is when I said, we got something strange going on, because it was a push tire.
When I read this, this is the thing that got me.
That's right. The push tire, you know, it probably uninflated or whatever, you know, if you probably 350 pounds.
Well, you got to tell everybody, the push tire on a tractor is the rear tire. It's the right. largest tire for those tire. Listening. The big tire, yeah.
And some folks back in the old times, I don't see it so often now, but people would take, when those tires wore out, they, instead of throwing them away, they'd put them in the yard and fill them up with dirt and make like a planter. Paint the tire white. Paint the bottom of the trees white. It's a Southern thing.
Yeah.
And, you know, folks just, y'all might understand, you from Texas.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. We've got some around here.
That's what I'm saying. You understand me.
Yeah.
Well, they put the thing out there, and he come out, you know, again, and said, look, you know, they're tearing up my property. And I stood out there with my mouth just hanging open. I looked up, and I did my best. We didn't have a ladder, but, you know, I looked for a place, because this thing's going to cause some marks in the bark of that tree. Mm-hmm. I never found a place for a pulley, a rope burn, nothing.
How high would you say it was up in that tree?
It was, well, guesstimating between 20 and 30 feet. Whoever had done it had to discus it. They had to, like, just pick this thing up and swing around and throw it straight up. And it hung on a big knot that was sitting up there. And I doubt it stayed there. The knot wasn't that big. You know, probably over time it has fallen down. But I haven't been out there in a long, long time or whatever. But it, like I said, at the time, my mouth was agape. And I just said, well, you know, I have no explanation for this.
And I know you also pointed out that you could tell that it hadn't. It looked like it had been removed from the ground, that tire, in one motion. It wasn't dug up. There wasn't tracks around it where people had been digging. It looked like it had simply popped it out of the ground like he would a 5-gallon bucket lid, pulled it out, and threw it. That was it.
Yep. Boss, whoever did it, they reached down with one hand. They picked it straight up, and it was embedded in the ground. It had been there for a while, and threw it up into that tree. And I knew then, like you said,
the investigation is changing.
That's right. I said, yeah. I don't know what this is, but I said, a human could not do this. And I played football for many years, seen some strong guys, and I've never saw anyone who could take 350 pounds and throw it up 20 feet in the air. Mm-hmm. Okay? It's a human impossibility. So it went on, and basically, time change. We got over into the next year, into 94, and I moved because just economically, I had to survive, you know. And mm-hmm. so I moved to another jurisdiction, but I kept my feet in a little jurisdiction that was in Pike County doing like a volunteer sort of thing. And I had made friends, you know, I talk about a man, a Christian man in this, and he was a good friend of mine. And so I kind of kept my toe in it, and I was still interested in this. And what I did was I went back and I told him, I said, look, I finally will get the time now to come back. And I want to cross your property. I want to get back down there along that creek. I said, I think the problem, the source of what's been going on here is I think somebody has either some kind of marijuana grow or they got something to steal, because we still had steals back then down on this creek, and they want you out of here. So he gave me permission, and I went out there, got off duty, and come up here in my, you know, I was in my private car, mm-hmm. and I parked and hopped out, and I went down through his yard and started walking the creek. And it was that gray sort of light. It was 7:30-ish in the morning, but it was a nice early April sort of, it was still a little brisk, but you know how it is when it turns to spring.
Oh yeah.
It's fresh. The air is fresh. And, and I'm walking down along the creek, and I was looking down at the creek, and the water level had fallen some. It probably in some places was only, 2-3 feet deep, but the water was very clear. And I got down probably a mile or so.
Still on this fella's property?
Well, no, I think I had crossed out of what was on the plat, and I was on somebody else's property.
So just searching those creek bottoms, looking for where somebody might have something hidden.
That's right.
Down in there. I got you.
All right. So I'm walking, and I looked, and one of the first things I noticed was down on my left as I proceeded, because I was moving in a southwesterly direction, and there was an empty corn bag. So I looked at it, and sure enough, it had been the brand that he had been getting from the feed store. I said, okay, well, I'm on the track of something. And I kept going down through there, and I noticed it was mud or silt mm-hmm. moving in the water at a certain point. And I kept going forward, and it had cleared some, and I saw what looked like footprints in the water. I got down, there was a copse of trees that I approached. And as I got there, I don't know, it was vaguely boomerang or banana shaped. There was a mud bank that was sitting in the middle of the creek. And as I got closer, I saw there was a disturbance in that mud. And I moved down there, and I looked, and then I stood watching the mud bank, standing on the edge of the creek bank. And I saw, and I couldn't believe it, frankly. I said, this is something that it just appears to be a footprint.
Mm-hmm.
So I climbed down, and I got down there in the creek. I went over and looked at it. And that was the place where, I don't know if anybody, your listeners or whatever, there's a place that you suddenly have everything you ever have believed torn away from you. And I'm not trying to be melodramatic, but I am trying to say that, you're faced with an impossibility, because what was in that mud bank in front of me was an 18-inch, 8-inch or so wide footprint. And that thing had sunk down probably an inch or two. And I was a big hefty boy at that time. I'm heftier now, unfortunately, but I was probably 250, and I was getting maybe a centimeter, a quarter of an inch when I stood on that bank,
mm-hmm.
and this went down 2 inches or so. And this is where it went really weird for me, because I felt the weirdest feeling come over me, like I was in mortal danger. I broke leather, man. I pulled my pistol out, and then I started scanning, because I was just tall enough on my tippy toes on that bank to look out over the edge of the opposite bank and the trees and the underbrush. It was pretty distance, and I turned and looked in every direction, and I never saw anything there nearby. But what I did figure out is I looked from the foot, and over on the other bank, there was a place indented. It wasn't a footprint, but it was a scuff mark where he pulled down, the force of lifting himself with that leg. Mm-hmm. And I saw there was a tree there. So whatever this was, it lifted its right leg or whatever, left leg, and he lifted himself up 8 feet or so over, then 3 feet up, holding on to that tree, and pulled himself and strode out of that creek on the other side. And honest to God, I mean, it hit me. It was fight or flight. And I said, well, you can't stay here. You've got to go. You've got to move. And I talked to people before, other investigators who said that, well, they think it's a pheromone that gets released. I have no idea. But I do know that I smelled ozone. It was crackly. It was like static electricity. And I've told other people about it, and they just poo-pooed it. And it's like, oh, you know. Well, I'm from the South. I know how thunderstorm is. I was born and raised. I know when ozone hits and it's about to rain, but there wasn't a cloud coming. It wasn't going to rain. So I've never been able to explain that. But I got up and I kept my pistol out. And it was, you know, I don't know if it had done the job or not. It was a 40 caliber Beretta Centurion. That's what we were carrying at the time. And to be honest with you, I didn't have any faith in the thing. In that regard.
At that moment.
At that moment, I just really said, well, it's better than having a stick. But
at least it's loud.
That's right. It ain't going to, whatever this is, this thing, it's not going to drop this guy. So I left. I went down and, you know, I kind of backed my way out of there. I didn't really want to turn my back from that location. And I got back down. And it hit me on the way. He said, well, you know, you've got to do this. You've got to take this cast. You've got the stuff in the truck. I said, you need to go back. And I don't know. I'm just going to be honest with you, man. I had a real man up session.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Back on that creek bank, you know, walking back. And I said, you're going to have to man up. You can't just walk away from this. So
I'm trying to put my, not to cut you off, Pat, I'm trying to put myself in your shoes. So this whole time, the numerous times you've gone out there, you're assuming these are people messing with this old couple. But when you finally saw the footprint, I'm imagining that eureka moment where like, oh God, I know what this is. Like you mentioned, you've seen the Patterson-Gimlin film when you were younger.
That's right.
You've heard the stories, but you always thought it was in the Pacific Northwest or Washington. And
that's right.
At that moment, without, you know, talking to yourself, you instantly knew this was something else. You knew what it was, even though you might not want to admit it.
It all comes rushing. I could picture myself, like you're talking about, being in your shoes, is that overwhelming sense of dread. Is like everything just got turned upside down and all that's come right. rushing in on you at one time. Like there's too much to process. I have to disengage and get that's away right. and try to slow this ride down to figure out what's going on, because I think right. I'm losing my mind.
That's right. That's right. You know, and also, I mean, I just can't emphasize enough that it was something primal. It was a feeling inside of me.
In your DNA.
That's right. You got it.
It knows it. Your DNA knows danger.
This thing, somewhere in the distant past, when I was, you know, my ancestor was sitting in the cave or up in the tree, wherever you want to say, but somewhere in my DNA, I knew that this thing was death.
Y'all crossed paths before. That's what you had to be like, ooh.
That's right. So, you know, in the next stage, you know, I went and got the cast, the plaster stuff, and mm-hmm. I went back down there. And, you know, I was still young. I was still rookie-ish. And, you know, I was all full of myself. You know, your first year out of the academy.
You talked yourself up now. Now you're going back in.
That's right. It's like, you know, man, I just retreated out of here and I'm the law. And, you know, we had all saying back in those days when we were dirt road sheriffs and stuff is this, you're not a good police officer till you get your tail whooped one good time. And then after that, you mellow out. And that's what happens is, you know, I got back down and said, no, you need to go back down there, because the justification part of my logical mind set in and said, you know what? That's there, but you just had a bad reaction because of X, Y, and Z. You need to go back down there. There's some kids. Somebody's out there, you know, They're trying to scare this old
man. I picture you pacing around trying to pull yourself together with these art supplies in your arms. Like, all right, here we go.
That's right.
I think he's trying to convince himself it's going to be okay down there.
I mean, you can't
call anybody because they're going to think you're out of your mind.
That's right.
You're like, nope, I'm just going to have to do this. Is how people go missing, Pat. This is what you're doing is how people go missing.
That is absolutely correct. You know, hey, and I touch on that in the book, man. You know, what I was doing was foolish, and I continued this foolishness after this for several years. But I went up there, got the stuff, went back down there, and I made the cast. And you know what? Here's the thing. I got back down there. It was just like being in a creek. There was no sense of danger. The ozone smell had gone. It was just what it was. I mean, it was like, you know, okay, I got this big footprint. So I cast it, and I looked up, and that's when I saw the stride path from the footprints that were submerged in whatever this was. I mean, like I said, I estimated in that thing probably about 68, 72-inch stride. And I said, this has got to put this boy up at 8 or 9 foot tall, at least, to do that. Well, I'm not going to say I tarried, but I did look around while the cast dried, and I took the cast and I took my big tail and I went up and I didn't go bother him because I have real respect for the elderly people. Okay, I'm getting elderly myself now, but I was raised, you know, we were raised, and it's like, I'm not going to go over and scare these old folks. This is bad enough that I've seen this.
Yeah. He don't need to see this.
He don't need to see this. Because she's going to see it, and she was a sweet grandmama, you know. She's got to live in that house. So I took it, and it dried. And my next step was, because I wasn't at that agency anymore, I said, okay, I'll go talk to the guy who was my former supervisor. And I went out there to his house, and he lived even further out in – you know, I describe in the book, you know, we went out there and he didn't want, I kind of described to him, he said, you want his family to see it because he had two little boys at the time. You know, I think he's, you know, he didn't want to stay up all night because if somebody sees this walking around, you know how babies are.
You don't want to plant that seed in anybody's mind.
That's right. You're looking for some 3 a.m. wake up to do that. So I went out, put it in a trunk of a car I had, and went out there, and he looked at it. And he just surprised the fire out of me because he said, oh, I've seen those before. And my mouth just fell open. You know, he said back there along the Flint River, in the river bottoms there. And he went on to tell me about his uncle and there being mounds and stuff on down in the river. And, you know, apparently, I mean, it was just an undercurrent of knowledge that I did not.
They didn't speak about it either.
That's right. No. It just wasn't, nobody talked about
it. Which when you get involved in this, as you've done over the years, you find out that that's kind of just part of it.
That's right.
That's like the main tale is you find out a lot of people out there and are involved or know rather, and just don't talk about it until somebody asks them. They don't volunteer information ever.
Ever. No. I mean, and I didn't. The simple fact is, once I had shown him, I told him, I said, because I'm going to be a good guy. I said, you need to, you know, you need to talk to the chief deputy and the sheriff. I said, you need to find out what needs to be done. Because I said, even though I made this cast, I said, I want you to have the knowledge and pass it on to them. Well, he said, all right, you hold on to it. And said, I'll get back in a week or two. And the election was coming up. And he told me point blank, he said, sheriff don't want any kind of panic. We don't need this sort of thing. And he said, that stuff's calmed down over there anyway. We're not getting calls anymore. And it did. Subsequent to this, it stopped. And, you know, it entered into my mind. I want the listener to understand, and you, that at this point, even though I'd seen this, I still felt in a certain way that there was a possibility that I was being subject of a joke. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So I was like, you know, they're going to extreme lengths to make a Bigfoot footprint down this creek. They didn't know if I was going to go down there or not. But part of my logical mind says, you need to cool out. You just take this and keep it as a memento or whatever. And it's what happened. I put it up in the closet, and I started having dreams after that, like PTSD dreams. Like, I'd wake up sweating, heart beating fast. I'd find myself for the next couple of years, you know, and I'm still in law enforcement, but I had moved into gang task force sort of stuff, and mm-hmm. I was working with street gangs, but I'd get these periodic dreams. And then, you know, my wife, you know, slowly over time, she'd tell you if she was here, that, you know, I would wrestle in my sleep and we'd be in foot chases and all this other stuff going on because of law enforcement. But these particular dreams, you know, I'd just wake up petrified. Well, it set up in my closet for about 3 years up on the top shelf. Got dusty and everything. And I encountered a friend of mine, and he was talking about himself. You know, it piqued my interest. He said he was thinking about going out to Washington State. And it's like, you know, why? You know, I'm going to go look for Bigfoot. He said, he described the tracks and everything. And I said, look, I have a track. And that piqued his interest. And he was like, well, let me see it. Well, again, you know, one thing led to another. So next thing you know, we sent it out to Grover Krantz, who was still alive at the time. Mm-hmm. Well, Krantz didn't, you know, he looked at it and sent it back. It made that trip. It survived it. And Krantz said it looked good, but he wouldn't make a ruling on the validity. And I was like, well, you know, it's just a hoax, whatever. And then Steve said, well, no, let's send it to Meldrum because he's doing this too. So he sent it out to Dr. Jeff Meldrum. And it stayed there for a while. They looked at it, and he sent it down to a fellow out of, I don't know how near you are, to Plano, Texas.
Yeah, it's pretty close.
Pretty close. Jimmy Chilcutt is this guy's name. Mm-hmm. And he was an expert on primate, you know, fingerprints and that sort of thing. Well, in the end, they sent back, and I included the report. They had found microdermal ridges and all sorts of things subsequent or consistent rather to a primate. And it was at that moment I think it just finally sunk into me that okay, I can sit down now in what you encountered, whatever it was not natural. Whatever this thing was, it may be flesh, you know, in mm-hmm. blood, in the sense that it's there, but it's not something that's part of the regular flora and fauna.
Right. And it also right. was, and it was proven that it wasn't a hoax. Like this was a real right. footprint. Right.
Right. He told me, I mean, at the time it was said that this was the first valid cast or Bigfoot footprint they'd examined east of the Mississippi River. And, you know, I'm sure there's probably others, but since then, I don't know, because I just really don't keep up with that aspect of it anymore. But, you know, from there, we started, and we had the idea, said, well, let's go looking for this thing. Because if it's out there, and it's as big as this, there's no possible way that it could hide very well from us. And, you know, we'd go as a group. We'd start, you know, looking, and we did find some other footprints, but we never found anything as pretty and as castable as that footprint. Mm. And over time, you know, we did research and we did all the stuff that I think most normal people do, because I think that's when a person encounters this, they reach out for information. And I read and read, you know, I got books from the 60s and the 70s, and I read about this, and I basically just swallowed it hook, line, and sinker, like most folks do, you know, that they're roaming ape pods walking around North America. Mm. And I said, you know, I will get it. We went out and got some big rifles, you know, 375 Holland and Holland Nitro Express. You know, yeah. we're gonna take big boy down.
Yeah, that's an elephant gun. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah, we're gonna pop him. And, but you know what? Here's the thing. I tried all sorts of stuff. I did the baby crying thing, children playing thing, just from what people said they were doing on the West Coast, you know, and I would go through these extreme lengths to get it. Never found anything. I tried to reach out, you know, to the Bigfoot community, but the fact that some of the aspects of things I reported later just didn't add up to it being a flesh and blood animal, that kind of got shut down. And I said, well, I'm just going to keep on rocking. I said, I'll just do this. And the research center, the guys that were there, everybody drifted on apart, as people do. But I kept at it. And I don't know, probably on, I got my answer, is what happened. Is around 2011 or so, I went out there, and I would use the excuse I'm going to go, you know, look for scrapes and stuff to go deer hunting. Mm-hmm. But really, I was going out looking for Bigfoot, and I'd carry, you know, I got a little outfit going. I'd carry 308 across my shoulder, and I had a 357 Magnum on my hip. And I said, this, you know, those are both hefty cartridges. If this thing's flesh, if that 308 don't drop him, I can get him with 357 up close. You know, I'm, you know how it is. I mean,
yes, sir.
I'm an educated redneck. You know what I'm saying? I know my stuff. And so I'm out there, and I started following a set of footprints, and it was during the wintertime, and followed them for a good long while. Probably, my guess is 200-300 meters. And this is what changed me completely, was I went up and I found there was a circle of trees, and they were hardwood trees. Now, if they were a slick, like a slick bark river oak, would be my guess is what they were. Followed them up, went up this little rise that come up out of the bottoms up there. Nice prints. They're good impressions. Got in the middle of that ring of those trees, and they stopped. Just stopped dead right there. So I went in a circle. So I said, well, what, maybe, you know, they hopped out, or it'll start on the other side of the circle. Mm-hmm. So I started doing what a tracker does, and I went in concentric circles looking for sign. And I went, and I went, probably an hour or so. I mean, I just kept looking and kept looking. And I finally just had to conclude that whatever had made those tracks had walked in the center of those trees and just disappeared.
Right.
And I know we get now, a lot of folks want to call this the woo factor or whatever, but the fact of the matter is, I'm sitting here, you know, got a King James Bible. I'll put my hand on it. You know, it stopped and it disappeared. And I didn't, like I said, I didn't have any kind of feeling like I was in danger or something, but part of me went and said to myself, you are no longer dealing with what people say is out here. I said, there is something out here. These people aren't wrong that there is a flesh and blood. There's some kind of in something out there with mass. But if it can disappear, you're not dealing with an ape. And you're not dealing with Cro-Magnon, man. You're not dealing with a hominid. This is something else. And I backed out of there, and that ended me. That ended me going alone into the woods to search for this thing.
Mm-hmm. Right. Wow.
Because if it can disappear, it can take you with it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And, you know, so I just felt, I'll be honest with you, I mean, for a little while, I just felt like crazy, man. But I sat down and I changed my way of research, and I stopped looking so narrowly in a myopic manner. And I started looking for correlations across the broad spectrum of the paranormal. And the first thing I noticed was a lot of the smells and the feelings and impressions that Bigfoot gave were common in some UFO sightings, were common in some hauntings. And then I just, over time, I just started seeing this umbrella. And I say in the book, it's like I've been looking at one tree, but really it was the entire forest.
Mm.
Now, what can I say? I don't know. I've read lots and lots of stuff. I'm particularly fond of Jung, the psychologist. He has lots of insight into the subconscious mind and that sort of thing. And then, you know, I researched and researched, but the thing, I think the thing that just broke me through this was reading the accounts from the American Indians.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And they said, essentially, that it was a spirit being, and it could come and go as it pleased, and that sometimes they were nice and sometimes they were nasty, and the best thing you could do was avoid them. You know,
yeah.
And I thought about it. I said, well, you know, these people, they're not dealing with science. They're dealing with survival. And that's where it changed my mind to the point that this has been going on. It has been going on for centuries, perhaps thousands of years. These people had to learn about these creatures to survive, not to deal with scientific method. And then once I saw that, you know, and there are many examples, you know, all of the things that I had encountered, they were encountering.
Yeah, and that, not just in North America, but all over the world. From
all over the world.
Yowies to Yeren to Almastis, Yeti, Orang Pendek. I mean, the list goes on and on.
That's right. You have these cryptid hominids winking in and out. Now, what does this mean? I don't know what it means, but I think on a spiritual level, and I, you know, I'm going to confess and tell you right up front, you know, I'm a Christian person. My denomination is a Baptist, a hardcore Baptist even. But the thing is what I want people to understand is we see things through an opaque veil between us and the other side and the other spirit world. We have forsaken as a species all of our history in the spiritual aspects of this planet, and we are relying solely on science. Well, that's fine. But on the other hand, we also have thrown away a huge amount of information about what potentially is going on around us.
Right.
And I opened myself back up to that. And I just said, well, I don't know if this is right or wrong, but this just seems to fit better than the idea that we have apes walking around on this continent. Now, you know what? If you said the Himalayas, and this was exclusively the Himalayas, I might say, okay. But not only is there governmental technology, nowadays we got like Elon Musk. I mean, he's got satellites.
Mm-hmm,
we got people walking around with FLIR. We got people walking around, you know, with this advanced technology. And yet nobody. And we've been looking at it. We're approaching 80 years since this became popularized back in the 50s and the 60s. And we've had lots of hoaxes. We had lots of people say that, you know, I found it. But it always never seems to come to fruition.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, it's very frustrating.
It's frustrating. But, okay, let's take it a step further. Columbus landed in 1492, right?
Mm-hmm.
All right. Well, the Spanish came. You know, some people say they settled and invaded. That's your opinion. But they spread everywhere. And, you know, they were taking specimens of everything. Never found this. The natives, and they were taken down, even back to the, you know, we're going back 4,000 years or something. They're taking down mammoths, mastodons. We find the bones of these creatures on this continent, but never once have we found the bones that fit the description of this creature.
That's right. Yet so many people report seeing strange things in the woods. I mean, there's thousands of documented sightings. There's probably tens of thousands of people that have seen stuff and just never come forward. I personally know 6 or 7 people that have seen things and they've never talked about it other than to me, but they've never reported it to the BFRO or any other organization. They don't want anything to do with it.
That's right. And that was, you know, when I put the sightings in, I had to be really on the down low to get these people to talk to me. And in fact, I when I came to the notion, okay, maybe you just need to publish this and pass this information on in case you go away, so somebody else might find some of what you said useful. All these stories, most of the people I approached, if not all, that I put in the book, 3 people said, no, I don't even want you to put a story in a book because somebody might find out. But everybody else said, yeah, you put the story, but I don't want nothing to do with this. I had went to a lawyer, you know, and I talked to him about it. And he said, well, you could just use pseudonyms and do this to protect your privacy. And so I went ahead and did it that way. It's not popular, and people don't want to be, you know, to appear to be mentally ill or whatever. And even, I don't know, it's just frustrating to me as a person who's been an investigator that, you know, we have information out here, and people try to report it, but then because it doesn't fit a certain narrow parameter of what we're going to accept in our theory, they discard the report.
Yeah. No, you're right.
That's right. I mean, you know, it's not a correct way to research. You take it all. I'm not telling you have to swallow it. Bigfoot shows up in a clown suit and he's handed you a beer, whatever. I'm not telling you to. You have to accept that as a real report, okay? But what I am saying is, if you've got something out there, you know, like the guy in North Carolina, and I this is a secondhand. I put it in the book, but you know, he's sitting up in his deer stand. He hears something heavy walking around him, can't find it. He, you know, keeps looking. Finally, something, he said it was invisible, moved like a big bush out of the way and started walking away.
Yeah.
Okay, what was that?
Yeah.
What was that? You see?
Oh, and, I know. We get hundreds of emails, and sometimes the same kind of deal where people – please don't read this on the air. I just want to share it with you and Cam.
Right.
And I mean, bizarre sightings, like things you can't put in a category. They're so bizarre. And, right. And I think that that's the best way to approach the subject matter is to keep an open mind, think right. Beyond just flesh and blood. And man, I want to thank you so much, Pat, for coming on today. Like I said, I want to thank you about writing this book and sending us the book. The book is Elkins Creek, elk like in the deer elk, Elkins Creek. Tell people, Pat, where they can buy the book, where they can find the book.
Okay.
Or well, anything.
No, go ahead.
No, I was going to say, or anywhere else, anything else you'd like to promote other than the book?
Well, you can find the book in either a paperback form or electronic form, Amazon and Barnes & Noble, Rakuten, Kobo, basically every retailer out there. But let me add this too, because I told you about this before we come on. And if you're out there and, you know, you don't have money, if you're a young person in high school or middle school, this book is especially written for you. And if you can get it at your local library, I appreciate the people who would spend the money and buy the book in any form. I want them to understand I appreciate your patronage, but my heart is not about money. My heart is about transferring this information to a young generation. And if you get it at the library, read it, use it. I put a little section in the back to help people start investigating and thinking for themselves. I don't care about the money. Listen to me now. You know, I'm sorry. I sound like a preacher, but I really don't care about the money. If you get the book, I appreciate it. But if you can get it for free, if you can read it out there, get this information and go out and help solve this mystery.
Yeah, that's a great message. If people want to email you or get in contact with you, Pat, is there an email or something that they can reach out to you?
Yes, sir. I put up a website, jpakin.com. And there is a contact form on there. And I put a little warning at the bottom because, you know, I don't want to be harassed. I just, you know what? I just want to express my opinion. Okay. And, you know, if you're serious and you just really want to, you know, share something with me or talk to me, whatever, I'm more than welcome to please write me because I enjoy it, you know.
Yes, sir. But,
you know, you want to take and drive me off. That's not going to happen, you know. So,
Okay, well, I'll put links to all of that in the show notes. And once again, Pat, thanks for coming on the show today.
Oh, thank you guys so very much. And you know what? I'm a big fan of Expanded Perspectives, and I hope your expansion continues.
Thank you very much. Talk to you next time.
All right.
And we're back with Expanded Perspectives. Once again, thanks, Pat, for coming on the show. It was a pretty cool story. His story, I especially enjoyed. He's good at telling a story. And like we talked about so many times, is I like it when there's sightings by somebody in law enforcement or something like that, because these people are trained observers. And I like the fact that it took him so long to be convinced that this wasn't a person. Like, he didn't go in there immediately like, oh, this sounds like something squatchy. You know what I mean? Yeah. He had to be convinced. And even after he cast the footprint, he still thought he was being hoaxed. Like, whoever these people are, now they're faking footprints.
Yeah.
And it's a very interesting read. If you're interested, I'll put links to it on the show notes. But, you know, you can find it everywhere. He said Amazon, things like that. Elkins Creek, Elkins Creek. And it's not just the story he shared with us on the air. There's a lot of other stories. I especially like some of the interviews he was doing with other people. And there's one really interesting one where he was talking to like a forest ranger. And the forest ranger, talks about how it's kind of known amongst other forest rangers in this particular area. Not really supposed to talk about it. It just leads to trouble. But it's one of those things, like, you hear that story so many times that whoever these people are that work for the Forest Service, they know a lot more than they're willing to come forward with. And I just find that stuff so interesting. What did you think about Pat in the book?
As a human being, Pat's great. I love the guy. I mean, he's just so genuine. Like I told you, and like you just brought up when we discussed it before we ever had him on, I love the fact that he went into this whole thing without, like, that this wasn't even on his radar. Like, the idea of finding a Sasquatch or seeing a Bigfoot or any of that wasn't even on his radar whenever he first started talking to the older gentleman. And like you, it's when you don't think about it and then you have this happen, like, you can tell in his voice genuinely, like, he was overwhelmed when he found the track. Like, it's something, and I can't, and you try, you read it and you listen to other people tell their stories and you read these stories, but you can't, because without having something like that to turn your world upside down, you don't really know what it would feel like, that experience. And I think he does a good job of conveying it. And it's just one of those things, like you and I've always talked about, whether it's real or not, or people around you believe it's real or not, that action, I mean, it's affected him. It completely changed his life. So, yeah, I mean, I enjoyed it.
One of the particular parts I found interesting with the story is how when he first started reporting to the elderly couple's house, the old man would tell him, well, we know when they're coming because we can smell them. And he's like, what do you mean you can smell them? He's like, no, it smells so bad we can smell them through the house. Like, the old couple wouldn't go outside.
That's bad.
They could smell it and they knew it was coming. And he's, you know, like, you know, in your mind, you're thinking, well, if a person's pranking him, how could you smell it? And then over time, Pat began to smell it.
Yeah.
And one of the really interesting parts was the time when Pat found the print and he mentioned the smell of ozone.
Yep.
And Pat himself didn't even know that that's pretty common with not just Sasquatch, but other strange encounters, whether it's a gnome or what, anything otherworldly, is the smell of ozone, the feeling of static electricity in the air, the smell of sulfur sometimes. I mean, we went into great length with Joshua Cutchin in his interview about it. But fantastic read. If you're interested in Sasquatch, Bigfoot, whatever, or you just like a really good story, I suggest you pick up Elkins Creek. It was fun talking to Pat. Thanks again for coming on. Cam, what do you got planned for your week?
Hard work and clean living, baby.
Well, that's good. Keep you out of trouble.
That's right.
I can't wait to see some of this woodworking you're going to be doing.
Oh, yeah, you'll check it out. I'll be building all kinds of stuff. I got some few ideas of some things I need to get knocked out. But, yeah, it's this week will be busy. It'll be more samples. Weather's getting good, more woodworking.
Heck, yeah.
More stuff like that.
Right on. If you have any stories of your own you'd like to share with me and Cam, please email the show at expandedperspectives@yahoo.com. You can follow us on all forms of social media. Till next time, folks, I'm Kyle Filson. He's Cam Hale.
Peace, y'all.